KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm going to be, I'm very excited to have a repeat guest back on the show, Eric Davis, the author of Technosis, the book focusing primarily and broadly on mysticism and technology and the intersection of those two worlds, and both in the creation of technology but also in what technology means to us as human beings. It's a fascinating book, and it's an interview that Eric and I did probably about a year ago roughly on Hearsay Culture, and you can find it by going to hearsayculture.com. Eric, being a very busy and as well as eclectic author, has come out with a new book called The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape. Now, hearing that title, for those of you that are regular listeners, you think, well, this doesn't sound like an intellectual property book, and in fact, it really isn't. The technology aspect, how does that fit together, Dave? In other words, why is Hearsay Culture speaking to the author of The Visionary State? Well, let me give you an idea of what this book is about, because the subtitle, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape, should give you an idea. In Eric's book, which, aside from the text being quite interesting, is complemented by photographs by Michael Rauner, has basically traveled the state looking for different aspects of the spiritual world of California. And he notes that he's not, and he doesn't spend as much time on the more traditional religions and spiritual practices of people in California. So he doesn't focus as much on Jewish synagogues or Catholic churches, although he does have aspects of both. But he really focuses on different ways that Californians through history have in one way or another enveloped their own spiritual beliefs and spiritual structures into the landscape of the state. And the photographs, which are remarkable, really accentuate that point. So, okay, now you're probably saying, well, Dave, this still doesn't sound like technology, but let me go a step further. A lot of what the spiritual landscape that Eric discusses, and Technosis really covers this as well, focuses on how these spiritual beliefs impacted the technological advances that California rightfully lays claim to. And so we're going to be discussing, among other places, places at Stanford University, where, of course, KZSU is located, and its spiritual landscape, as well as issues as far-ranging as the Mormon experience in California, to, in fact, even geographical and geological formations that, and there are photographs of these as well, that impact the topography of the state as well as its spiritual aspects. I thought it might be useful to contextualize this a little more by noting that in the coda, at the end of the book, Eric quotes the beat poet Lou Welch, in the context of discussing where California is, and he has excerpts of a poem which he connects to an earlier poem by Walt Whitman. The poem begins, "Human movements, but for a few, are westerly. Man follows the sun." Later in the poem, he points out, "or follows what he thinks to be movement of the sun. It's hard to feel it as a rider on a spinning ball." And notes that at the close of the poem, the author, Lou Welch, says, "This, being California, is the last place. There is nowhere else we need to go." And as Eric points out in the coda, as the last place, California has inevitably carried a heavy symbolic load, as, and that's a quote from the book. So we're going to be discussing the symbolism as well in California and how California really has made these contributions, primarily to technology. Obviously, that's a focus of this show. But more broadly, the spiritual world that California has both promoted as well as given, if you will, to society. For those of you that aren't familiar with Eric is a San Francisco-based writer, culture critic, and independent scholar. Technosis, the previously mentioned book, which is subtitled Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information, came out in the fall of 98 and, in my view, still has enormous relevance today. He's a contributing writer for Wired and also wrote the posthuman condition, which I do remember from the Departed, as he points out, online magazine feed. He has a number of essays that have appeared in different books. He's taught at the California Institute for Integral Studies, the New York Open Center, and Esalen, and was one of the organizers of Planet Work, a conference on information technology and global ecology held in San Francisco in the year 2000. Appropriately for our discussion today, he is also a fifth-generation Californian, and so therefore his perspective on California comes from having deep roots there. I should also note, and I'm not going to be able to connect this as clearly, but one of my favorite books on music is a shorter book that Eric wrote a few years ago for the 33 and a third series by Continuum on Led Zeppelin IV, or what people often refer to as Zoso. We're going to spend a few minutes on it towards the end if we have time. It's a great little book focusing on how that album was created, and we'll touch on it towards the end. So with that, let's turn to the discussion. And if I've done my job properly, Eric, it should be still on the phone. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much, and thanks for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Sure.
Let's start right off with the obvious first question. What brought you to write Visionary State?
Yeah, that's a, you know, it's a good one because, well, let's see, there's a couple of different angles in. I think the main one is that at a certain point in my life, kind of after 9/11, everything was sort of confusing. I wasn't really sure where I was going, and I was in that kind of period that we have in our lives sometimes where we look for guidance, you know, we look for deeper roots. And I had a friend at the time who was about my age going through similar kind of issues, and what he did when he was, you know, facing this kind of problem was to go back to the religion of his youth. He was raised Jewish, had sort of drifted away from it, and kind of returned with an, albeit with a very California twist, that he was going to a temple that had a, you know, lesbian rabbi, and they did sort of ecstatic Kabbalah dancing, etc. But he was also clearly kind of returning to the religion of his roots. And I was kind of envious because I didn't have anything like that. I grew up in Southern California, suburbia. You know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High was more or less my high school, and I just didn't have any kind of religious upbringing at all. And I started to think about that and think more about California and more about my own experience growing up at the tail end of the counterculture when there were so many weird cults and sects that were around, especially coastal California where I was, where in high school, we would, just for a lark, we would go to the Hare Krishnas and chant and eat their food, and we went to the city yoga center and meditated, and there was a guy in my public high school who taught this class called epistemics, and he was actually a former Est guy, and he kind of brought like these sort of human potential ideas into a public, you know, high school class. And so there was a lot of this ambient weirdness of growing up in California, just on top of the surfer culture and the drug culture and the Grateful Dead and all this kind of stuff that I was very much a part of as a teenager. So when I was looking back at it later, I went, you know, California is really weird. Like, all that stuff they say about how peculiar California is actually kind of true. There's an enormous amount of unusual sects, groups, subcultures, fads, manias, obsessions, mysticism, etc., that has occurred in the state. And I was like, why? Why is my state, why is my home state, why is my tradition, if you will, this completely bizarre melange of all of these hopes and dreams and fears and creative craziness? And so I said, well, let's find out. And, you know, there really wasn't anything about it, even though it, in some ways it's one of the most fundamental things people would say about California, and they have been saying for decades and decades, that no one had ever really looked at it. No one had ever tried to tell the story. So I wanted to tell the story. I wanted to figure out, why did this state become the way it was? What are the major stories? What is the relationship between all of this religious activity or spiritual searching and the other things that California is known for? Its media culture, its fads, its youth obsession, its technology, and its futuristic kind of forward leading quality, which it's been playing in the American consciousness for, you know, well over a century. So that's what set me going.
You know, it's interesting that you point out that this hadn't been covered in a significant way or at all, because, and perhaps it's an interesting point to consider, California has this reputation as being wacky. And certainly I know from having spent a few years in California and then moving back east, I get a lot of interesting reactions when I say, oh, yeah, I lived in Northern California. You know, how much of, out of curiosity, this is perhaps more your own gut as opposed to anything factual, but, you know, do you get a sense as to why perhaps a book like this hasn't been written? In other words, is there anything under the surface that says, you know, this is something that California perhaps wants to distance itself from or be known for something else? Because obviously there's enormous political diversity in the state as well, but when people tend to think of California, they often think of its extremes as opposed to, you know, the run-of-the-mill, if you will. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there is, you know, quite a significant literature on California as a cultural place, as a unique culture in the Americas, and certainly some of those books address the overall kind of wacky factor, if you will. What people had not done was to really look at it as a specifically religious or spiritual phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So usually what people would do is they would tell stories kind of around it, like they would talk about the history of Buddhism in America. And if you're going to tell the history of Buddhism in America, half this your story is talking about stuff that happened in California. Or if you're talking about the 60s, you want to talk about the revolution of the 60s, you know, in America, you talk about that, and half of what you're talking about is happening in California, over half. And so there's these individual stories that people have told, but no one had ever tried to bring it together and look at it as an expression of a place. Hmm. Of a regional culture with its own particular forces, and I think it's partly because it's hard to wrap your head around it, and it's challenging, and also that from the outside, a lot of the stuff that I write about just seems kind of ephemeral and goofy, and what's the point? Like, who cares about UFO cults from the 1950s? Who cares about, you know, EST? Who cares about the Rosicrucians in you know, San Jose building their Rosicrucian Park in the 1930s. It's all just kind of this odd little bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But when you bring it all together, you start to see that it's part of a much wider sort of shift in consciousness and culture in America. And I think it's people are a little kind of disturbed by it. They don't know how to deal with it. And so they don't really think about it as a significant religious or cultural phenomenon, but just a bunch of little wacky stuff that goes on at the edge of the country. So that's really what I wanted to do, is to take it seriously,
mm-hmm.
to say, what's going on here? Why does this happen? What are the deep forces behind it? How does it influence the rest of the state? How does it influence America as a whole? Because a lot of these ideas, a lot of this kind of weird mix and match spirituality, you can call it New Age if you want to, a lot of it really came out of California, and it's gone on to influence America and the world in a lot of ways. I mean, similar things are happening in other places, but I think the phenomenon itself is really quite interesting and significant, and so that's really what I was happy to bring my attention to.
The focus of the book being what it is, it's jumping ahead a little bit, but I think it would be good to ask this question now as opposed to later. If there's a takeaway, if you will, that you want the reader to have going through the book, and we'll talk about the format in a moment, because it's obviously a different read than a typical book where there are no pictures or very few, what would be the takeaway?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially in the context of the other conversations we've had before,
mm-hmm.
about technology and culture. In a nutshell, California has long been recognized in the national psyche as a place of the future, that a lot of the things that have come from here have gone on to influence the country and the world. But just talking about the country, and these things across the board, you know, political transformations like Prop 13, a huge number of fads and cultural events and ways of being, lifestyles, the media industry, Hollywood, the personal computer revolution, the hippies, you know, on and on and on. A lot of environmental stuff is from the West Coast. So it's legitimately seen as a place of the future. And I believe that it is, and it still is, and that in some ways you can look at California in good ways and certainly in bad ways as a kind of petri dish of the future. You know, some of the less pleasant aspects are things like, you know, McDonald's and freeways and, you know, some of the larger initial, you know, kind of tract homes. And a lot of the stuff comes from, you know, from the kind of crass commercial culture of California, which can be quite overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so my takeaway is that the peculiar religious and spiritual phenomena that I talk about in my book are attempts, sometimes conscious and sometimes unconscious, for people to try to find a way to get meaning and understanding and insight as we enter into this, call it a post-human world. As we enter into the world of the future, how are we going to maintain some of the things that are powerful and good about religion or spirituality while recognizing that their forms have to change in order to meet and balance and survive in what is in some ways a very dystopic situation that we face, I think, or certainly a very confusing one that we face in as we look towards the future. So that the stories that I'm telling are not just interesting little historical tales, they're actually glimmers or reflections of a process that we're all kind of involved in as we, whether we want to or not, live in a place that's a little bit more like California.
Mm-hmm. It's an ambitious goal, and I think your book does in fact cover a wide variety of areas, and perhaps, you know, this is a good time before we get into some of the examples that you use in weaving this tale, is the format itself. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is a book that is adorned with many photographs and textual description to contextualize it. In terms of traveling with a photographer, perhaps I'll ask about that process as well as how you chose the areas that you cover, because you cover places that are a little bit more well known, like Joshua Tree, but also many architectural examples of places that in fact have nothing more than a street address to identify them. So how did you go about picking your topics, and what was it like traveling with a photographer in working on this book?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you just a little backdrop. And so, I wanted to write the story that we've been talking about so far, and I started out as a conventional history book, you know, just with, you know, maybe 10 chapters, and I was trying to weave all this stuff together. And as I tried to create an overarching story, a through line, as they say, to put all this material together, it was incredibly difficult because I wasn't able to reflect the diversity and the multiplicity that is part of this culture, where there's many different perspectives, many different mutations, many different hybrids and combinations of different things coming from America, coming from Christianity, coming from the East, made up out of whole cloth, coming from science fiction, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many threads of the tale. And I realized, actually, that what I really wanted to do was to talk about the sort of the landscape, the cultural landscape of California as a place of diversity, just the way that the actual geological landscape of California is incredibly diverse, much more so than most places on the planet. So too is its culture have this quality of diversity, in particular the culture I'm talking about. So I kind of hit on a flash that the way I wanted to tell my story was as a travelogue, where we, you know, were visiting these places, these churches and temples and monasteries and sacred sites and holy hills, where the stories that I wanted to tell took place. So it was kind of a flip-flop. So I suddenly used the landscape itself became my map, became my outline. And as soon as that, you know, realization occurred, I knew that I had to have photographs. So I hooked up with this great photographer, Michael Rauner, who was totally enthusiastic about the project. Another native Californian, like me, grew up in San Diego, like me, interested in a lot of the spiritual diversity of the state. And so we started to pick sites, and a lot of the sites were stories that just had to be told. But a lot of them were also chosen because they looked cool, because they were interesting visually. as places to stir up the kind of wonder and fascination that drew both Michael and I into the project.
Mm-hmm.
So some places were chosen because of the way they looked. Most were chosen because of the stories we wanted to tell about them. And we just wanted to create a good balance so that there were the many different dimensions of the tale were being represented by these places, as well as geographically. We wanted stuff from the north and from the urban areas and from the rural areas and from different religious traditions and places that were huge and spectacular and places that were modest and humble, places that were well-known, places that were completely obscure. And so we just had to kind of come up with a nice balance. And, of course, you know, there are many stories that are left out. You know, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people who are like, you didn't even talk about Sufi Sam or whatever it is. And it's true. There's tons of great stories that are not in the book, but I'm happy to say that most of the ones that I think really need to be there are there in one form or another. But they're told through this journey through space and journey through architecture.
Well, perhaps you could have a B-sides version of the book in a few years, of all the stories that might anecdotally be related to what you were trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And in that way, please all of the people that think their story should have been in there.
That's true.
Let's jump into the book and perhaps I'll start here. You talk about in the introduction what you call the interplay of visionary imagination and cultural invention. And perhaps you could describe what you mean by that and where that interplay and intersection lies.
Great question. You know, from the outside, when people look at something like religion, and particularly kind of newfangled religion like you see in California, or, you know, where there's, you know, all of these different holistic body-mind practices and gurus and sects and human potential groups and occultists and all this kind of crazy stuff. It's like, it's a little like off-putting. Like, how do I think about this? You know, do all these crazy beliefs that I don't really believe in. And one of the ways I think it's really productive to look at religion, both newfangled and traditional, is to look at it in terms of the imagination, in terms of the creative imagination,
mm-hmm.
where people are trying to build new worlds, create maps, understand the cosmos, map it out, understand the forces behind it, and use the imagination as a way to do this activity. So you see, you know, newfangled religion particularly as an expression of the same kind of creativity that people bring to, you know, theater or art or architecture. It's just that it has sort of higher or different stakes. So that's one thing that seems really important.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that California is incredibly inventive. It has always been very technological. It has always been very sort of, you know, can do, make it happen, sometimes in a very DIY individualistic way, and sometimes from a very well-established state-funded kind of way. It's an incredibly self-inventing place. And at least, you know, once if we're talking about California as a state in the United States. And so what I see is happening is that these two things combined, that the creative imagination combined with inventiveness and to some degree with technology and with media. And it's that combination that led to so many of the phenomena that I'm interested in, not even just religious or spiritual groups, but also a lot of the cultural fads and transformations from, you know, muscle groups to the hippie movement to, you know, New Age healing fads and, you know, vegetarianism or, you know, other things that have played an important role in the state. There's something about the idea that the world you want, you have to make, and you make it through your practices, what you do with your body, what you do with your lifestyle, with your daily life, what you do with your media, what you do with your technology, and how you build that utopian world or that spiritual world through your creative activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, really a lot of the driving force behind the movements I talk about in the book, but also behind California in general.
The technological focus is an obvious one, and obviously is one of the main focuses of this show. And so, you know, perhaps I'll ask this kind of open-ended question before we, you know, dive into some of the examples that you discuss. But I guess I'll ask it this way, and perhaps it's a slightly loaded question, speaking to a fifth-generation Californian. But, you know, we have a technology, at least that ideally is designed to, at a minimum, share information. Now, that information may be shared freely or on a commercial basis. It could be jaded. It could be editorialized. It may not be accurate. But at least at its fundamental core, what we think of as the Internet today is a network of literally ways to share information. You know, that's the ideal, and certainly the founding, the true thinkers and visionaries of the Internet, by and large envisioned at least that, although they obviously, you know, differed on how it would be done and whether the commercial aspects would be appropriate and what have you. It leads to this question, you know, assuming for the moment that, you know, California did play a major role in development of the early Internet, and I think that that's, well established. You know, the question really is, could the technology, the Internet that we think of today, been developed anywhere else? In other words, does the visionary state that you describe, is it a unique environment that uniquely allowed for technology to develop, at least in that way, as we've perceived it?
Well, I mean, I would sort of like take it is a loaded question, and historically, as you can go, well, you know, who knows what would happen if you know, California had not, you know, been wiped off the face of the earth in 1889 or something like that.
Right.
Would humankind eventually have developed, you know, computer networking and, you know, packet switching, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah, probably. But the fact that it happened the way it did, and that you can show so in so many ways how some of the ideas and the enthusiasm and the models and the culture that helped create the elements of the Internet that we are so familiar with came out of this sort of what I call the California consciousness, this kind of interest in consciousness and how that works, whether you think about it spiritually or whether you think about it in terms of human potential. To me, it's one story at this point. And, mm-hmm. and I talk about some of that stuff in the book, but there's a lot more to be said about the way that ideas of social networks, the way that ideas of proactive technology, about individualistic technology, grow out of a lot of the experiments of the 1960s and 70s. Probably the most, like, you know, sort of sharp example is to just talk about Doug Engelbart, who in a famous demo in the late 1960s, which was recorded on video by one of Ken Kesey's merry pranksters, Stuart Brand, demonstrated a lot of the kind of basic language of computer networking. He showed the mouse, something essentially like email, something essentially like video conferencing, and he really kind of represented in a utopian way the possibility of a kind of group mind. Now, if you follow Engelbart's career and what he was motivated by, I mean, the man was infused with this California consciousness. Now, it didn't take the form of specifically spiritual or religious ideas, but he was deeply influenced by EFT and ideas in the human potential movement. His lab was notorious for its love of cannabis and more powerful, intelligence enhancers, if you will, and a lot of the rhetoric around Stanford Research Institute and other Northern California kind of tech outposts was infused with some of the energy that the merry pranksters had. Hmm. You know, the merry pranksters, this crazy transformative psychedelic acid test culture where the Grateful Dead was the house band. They were also had their ideas about how to use technology. They were, you know, using, recording equipment and, you know, projectors and microphones and, you know, weaving all of this sort of sensory overload into these communal fets, psychedelic fets that they were throwing called the acid test. Now, it's, you know, it's a big jump from there to, you know, the first node of the ARPANET. but it's not a huge jump.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you go into the specific stories about individuals, about significant individuals in that group, and other writers have talked about this. John Markoff wrote a book about it. Frederick Turner has written an excellent book about this kind of stuff. But it very much grows out of the same soup.
Hmm.
And so for that reason alone, I think that a lot of these stories are extra significant.
We're going to discuss some of those stories after the short break here. We're speaking to Eric Davis, author of the book, The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. At the bottom of the hour here, what I historically do and continue to do is ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that is housed at Stanford University and relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its broad range of programming. And for those of you, I should note, listening to this by way of a podcast, be aware of the fact that the show does originate at KZSU, and in fact KZSU is the basis upon which the show runs and the show continues, and KZSU gave me the opportunity to start Hearsay Culture. So even though you may be listening by podcast, there is a connection directly to KZSU. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, I encourage you to make that donation. You can do it a couple of ways. You can either email the underwriting department at KZSU by emailing underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the webpage for the radio station, and click on donate. Either way, and regardless of whether you do, I do hope you continue to listen to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture for its broad programming and support the station. So we're back with Eric Davis, author of Visionary State. And Eric, you started discussing some of the stories right before that very short break. And perhaps let's get into them. Although I do want to start with one interesting story that you get to early in the book, which is the experience of the Mormons, the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who are known, of course, for having settled and built a huge community in Utah, but in fact also have roots in California. My question, really, aside from briefly describing their story, is whether the Mormon experience in California is a crucible through which to view California mysticism and consciousness in terms of how those ideas developed.
I think that the fact that the Mormons threaded their story through early California is significant because it reminds us of what the spiritual stakes of the Western territories were in the middle of the 19th century. I mean, very briefly, that a small Mormon colony was one of the first group of Americans to settle in San Francisco once it was renamed San Francisco, very shortly after the Mexican-American War that resulted in California, soon becoming a state, that there were Mormons at the discovery of at Sutter's Mill of the gold. There were a number of significant places in the kind of origin story of California as an American state where you look to the side and there are Mormons. And you got to remember at that point that the Mormons were, the most significant and, to my mind, most interesting, most creative, in our sense that we were talking about the creative imagination, the most creative of American sects religious sects in the 19th century, that they were hounded and persecuted, and that they realized that they needed to find a new land. I mean, they in some ways repeated the archetypal American story, which is, a bunch of people who are not getting along with their neighbors strike out for the territories and want to build a city on the hill, want to build a if not a utopia, then at least a renewed civilization. And so some of these colonists first saw California as being potentially the site for the theocracy that Utah would shortly become.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of just showed the openness to me of that, of California, in terms of its the role it was playing in the imagination of America as a place for new beginnings, as a place for new social formations, for new ways of being. And in fact, it was a very unusual place in terms of religion. Most of America was pretty hidebound in its Protestant, Calvinist sentiments in the middle of the 19th century, with a small exception of some very dense urban areas. You're going to find a very dominant kind of religious tenor. And one of the things that makes California unique is that that culture never really took on here. I mean, yes, it's, you know, predominantly a Christian state, like all other, you know, states in the Union, but it was much more open and polyglot. That's one thing that we forget about the gold rush, is it's not just tons of people. It's tons of people from all over the world. In fact, in the, you know, 1851, San Francisco is going to be a more cosmopolitan city probably than any other city on the planet, because you had people from the East, you had people from South America, you had people from Europe, you had people from the, you know, the East Coast or the eastern parts of the United States, you know, mostly men, all thrown together, sort of relying on each other. And that produces, and you can see it very much in the accounts of the time, a kind of openness to the multiplicity of ways that people see the world. Suddenly your partner is a Catholic, or your partner is a German miner who uses occult techniques to find gold. Or, and then there's these, you know, Chinese guys down the street, and, you know, they didn't get along very well. It's a kind of ugly tale. But the fact that 10% of California was Chinese from 1850 on, and that number never goes lower than that, and actually grows higher a bit, you know, is really significant. So the Mormons are just one, in some level, another aspect of this openness, this possibility of different ways of seeing the world. And I think they probably made the right move by settling in Utah instead of trying to do it in California, because they would have had to gotten a lot more conflicts with people over the juicy land of the San Joaquin Valley. But I still think that they have this sort of a significant role to play in this, in the way that California was imagined in the 19th century.
And it's a history, of course, which of the Mormon Church, which is getting more of a focus today. I think a large measure because of the candidacy of Mitt Romney, but also with some of the recent books that have met with some criticism from members of the church. But I think it's an interesting way to, you know, consider that experience in California. And I think similar, although not related, is perhaps the experience of Stanford, in terms of what you discuss regarding the building and the vision of the famous chapel that's on campus, as well as the research institute, and obviously being a show that's based at Stanford University, I'd be remiss in not discussing it. But it does again play this role as another couple of examples of what you're describing. I was curious in reading the two entries whether in fact the history of the chapel, which was built in the late part of the 19th century, at the really inception of the university, is what the connection would be, and is that history intertwined with the more recent history of SRI?
I mean, to my knowledge, there's no direct linkage between the two. What I think is important more is the way that you find that even very mainstream institutions and cultural developments in California, if you look a little bit more closely, if you peel back the layers a little bit, you will almost invariably find a stream of this kind of spiritual wackiness, if you will. I mean, it's a somewhat condescending phrase, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, both SRI and the Memorial Chapel show that particular part of California, the, you know, Palo Alto, Stanford University area, has these things as well. In a nutshell, the basic tale of Stanford is that Stanford's son died really devastatingly early on in about the time that just before he just sort of had the vision of even creating Stanford University. So Stanford University, in some sense, comes out of this kind of grief over the loss of his son, Leland Jr. And they didn't just grieve him. but they tried to contact him. This was the era of spiritualism. This is the era when lots of people, lots of wealthy people, lots of people who were in power, lots of people who were well educated, went to seances and went to mediums. Now, that doesn't mean it was altogether accepted, and in fact, once this was discovered, the Stanfords got a lot of flack. But Jane Stanford, Leland's wife, was particularly enthusiastic and remained so throughout her life, as was one of Leland's brothers, who actually provided Stanford Library with a large and significant collection of spiritualist memorabilia, which is actually kind of hard to find out about today because the university isn't very excited about the fact that they had this material. So behind the story of the chapel, and in fact you can see some of the imagery in the chapter, in the chapel clearly refers to the experience of a dying child, et cetera, et cetera. Behind Jane's grief and the grief that in some ways founds the university or the desire to memorialize, you have this connection with the spirits. You have this connection with the spirits, and that also even ends up impacting the research that goes on at the institution, because there was an early endowment from Leland's brother for studies of the paranormal, and gradually that became studies of psychology. But the psychological research at Stanford owes its sort of origins, or at least some of its origins, to this stuff that, you know, most people nowadays would look at as being completely, you know, paranormal, you know, psyops kind of studies. So there was always that element there, and in some ways, you know, what happens with Stanford Research Institute is a kind of return of that same interest in the parapsychological aspects of the mind, or, you know, California consciousness. I don't think there are direct historical links between that. There's certainly nothing that I know of. Mm-hmm. But it's very clearly a repetition, if you will, of the same kind of pattern. So on the surface, SRI, you know, Research Institute, modeled something on the lines of the Rand Institute, which also had some very interesting, very innovative, very California ideas that it installed in its research institute. And you know, you're studying, you know, technology, you're working for the military, da da da. But peel back the layer a little bit, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, and you find, you know, Douglas Engelbart, you know, doing his his sort of consciousness fueled maps of the future of computing, and you find remote viewing. You find a procedure funded by the by DARPA and other institutes later, other spook mm-hmm. agencies later, to see if psychics can remotely see, you know, events occurring at other places, and, you know, it's full-on parapsychological work. And, you know, from our perspective now, it looks completely kind of kooky, and in fact, when it was revealed a few years ago, I mean, people had known about it for years, but it was sort of officially acknowledged a few years ago, it was kind of, there was all this uproar about it. But the more you know about California, the more it makes sense. It's mm-hmm. like, well, of course they were doing that. That was the era for this. That was the era when scientists that you would be employing at a place like SRI were also interested in in Scientology and parapsychology. That was just part of the milieu, and it was part of the creative milieu that I think really had an impact, even if those particular studies were not altogether successful, although, as far as I understand it, they are statistically significant, and in fact, all you really need to show is statistical significance to make parapsychology worth looking at. But leaving that aside, it was part of this larger culture of how does technology, how do techniques that we can use with our minds, with consciousness, help create and potentiate the human mind and human culture. And so from that perspective, you know, meditation practices, EST, human potential techniques, networked computers, user interfaces, all of those things are part of the same attempt to embolden and intensify human consciousness.
The you mentioned it's a fascinating story, but you mentioned the context of mainstream institutions like Stanford having these connections that that as you mentioned while not the nicest term, certainly people might think it's wacky or what have you, but somehow out of the ordinary, which of course implies that that's a bad thing, and then we know that that isn't always the case or often the case, and it leads me to kind of a question that's a little broader, but given how well versed you are in this area, I'd be curious to know what of all the stories and photographs that you reviewed for this book and ultimately placed in the book, what was the one, or maybe there isn't one, but what was one that was most surprising to you, where you found something that really really surprised you given the background and time you've spent studying this area?
Well, I mean, there were a number of really, marvelous discoveries of things that, I didn't know anything about. I mean, that's one of the great things about doing a project like this, is it just forces you to, peel back the layers and find more deep elements. But I think probably, especially in terms of technology, one of the things that was the most interesting to me was the fact that from the late 19th century through the middle of the 20th century, that the best telescopes on the planet were in California. Now, you go, well, they could have been there, they could have been in France, they could have been wherever. But from my perspective, where I see, in a somewhat kind of enchanted way, California is this weird harbinger of the future, this weird connection of consciousness and technology and culture, pushing the boundaries, seeing how far we can go. That character of California is very deep and pervasive. It was a very nice kind of acknowledgement of that to discover that these telescopes were part of that, because in a way the telescope is the perfect example of all of these elements. It's, on the one hand, a high technology. It's a technology of perception, essentially a kind of media. It is involved with a sort of cosmic awareness, literal mm-hmm. awareness of the cosmos, and it fundamentally transforms our model of the universe, of where we are, so that, the discovery that we're, that actually, we're just one tiny little galaxy in a universe of multiple galaxies, which is such a remarkable thing to have to remap, that comes from glimpses gained through these, technological eyeballs that are in California. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of, for me, reaffirmed that this process is going on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. And on that scale, I found that to be a not so much a surprise as a kind of joyful acknowledgement that the process that I was writing about seem to exist in multiple dimensions.
And we have about 10 minutes left, and I do want to kind of bring us forward to today and ask you a question along those lines. The cultural landscape that you describe, obviously, we're discussing Mormon history. I mean, we're going back quite a while. And I'm wondering whether you feel that this cultural landscape is today in terms of the creation and development of technology. How deep do you think that influences today with the fact that technology obviously is big business, and the fact that there are people entering and constantly, and not, again, not that this is wrong, but entering technological fields with a focus on turning a profit and making money. Is there a contradiction in that goal versus the spiritualism that you describe? And how deep is that spiritualism in your view today in the tech sector?
Well, I think that what's happened with a lot of the stuff that I talk about in my book is that it has just grown more diffuse and more. It's like being poured into the water supply. So it's not that you're going to find, CTOs at Silicon Valley companies who are also, meditating and practicing with a shaman. You will find a few people like that, but not that many.
Mm-hmm.
But what you will see, for example, is that human potential therapies that derive ultimately from EST and even from Scientology before EST have mutated and filtered their way into corporate seminars, into the ways that people think about and try to practice their jobs and even to rise to the top inside of Silicon Valley. Like the Landmark Forum, for example, is very big in the Silicon Valley and in tech industry in general. But from the outside, it doesn't really look that different than just sort of, the normal corporatese way of trying to organize social relations inside of a corporation and between corporations. But if you look closely, if you recognize the signs, you see them. But it's more diffuse. It's more kind of permeated that. So I think that in general, the tradition that I'm talking about in the book, that's sort of what's happened to it. We're not in the 1970s. We're not in the era of, crazy Eastern gurus and, whatever psychedelic explorations. We're in a more corporate world, in a world in which of course money is totally important, and that always has a weird tension with spirituality or with consciousness or with religion, though it's a complicated one. Abundance is part of both worlds, and so it's a more diffuse situation, just as technology or the creative edge of technology is no longer sort of geographically located. At the beginning of this discussion, you quoted that Lew Welch poem about mm-hmm. California being the last place. To me, what that means is that it's not still the last place. It's that we're not really in place the same way that we once were.
Mm-hmm.
At the 21st century, the landscape of the 21st century, the geography of the 21st century is a very, very different beast. That that interconnectivity, globalization, hypermediation, the speed of information, our awareness of how we are woven into all of these networks that span the globe has actually kind of increasingly undermined our sense of place, and that it doesn't make sense anymore to talk about regional cultures even the way we could do in the 20th century, let alone earlier eras of human civilization. So in that sense, it's still the last place. It's just no longer as significant as it was in the 1960s or the 70s or even the 80s. I think that there's still a lot of creativity that comes out of here, and there's still a tremendous amount of media, and you really still have to look at the economy of California kind of as a different country in some ways than the United States. I think it's fair to see it sort of on its own. I think that it makes sense to continue to see it as a place of the future. I mean, you can look at the stem cell initiative a few years ago led by our ridiculous, hilarious governator, which is itself a science fiction story,
mm-hmm.
Come alive, as being, a symbol of the way that California continues to kind of map the future. But I think in other ways it's more fair to say that it's diffused, that it's in the water, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And that diffusion, I think, is a good way to perhaps close with this question. I see your point with regard to the diffusion. Certainly, we could even take it from a much more basic level and just recognize that as populations grow, you have increased diversity in terms of viewpoints, and therefore there's more stuff, if you will, out there to compete for the same amount of space, and obviously the attention spans of individuals, which has been written about more and more from a technological standpoint, and I've had several guests on the show, including Richard Lanham, who's written about that particular aspect of it. Is the, in asking you a crystal ball question, which is normally not the most appropriate, but since we're talking about mysticism and visionary worlds, I feel more comfortable asking you to pull out your figurative crystal ball, though for all I know, you may actually own a crystal ball. So regardless of how you conjure this vision, I'm curious, if you were to project, let's say 20 years from now, Do you expect that this mysticism that you discuss in Technosis and you discuss here, and indeed the spiritualism, which we know the United States is a spiritual country, do you think 20 years from now there's going to be more or less diffusion of the kind of visions that you describe in the book?
I'm not sure whether to call it diffusion or not. I'll rephrase the question a little bit to give you my angle. Is that
okay?
One way that I think is very productive from a secular perspective to think about what happens in religion and what happens in new religious movements and in spiritual groups and all that. A secular perspective that can make sense of it and to understand it more is that these are experiments in consciousness. That consciousness is an extremely mysterious thing. Whatever kind of network consciousness we're creating with our machines, collaborative work mind, and just the nature of our own individual mind. We all know from introspection, from our own experience, what an extraordinary range of perceptions and of cognition and of other worlds that we can tap into with our minds. Every night we dream, we have something remarkable happen that we don't really understand. So just as the 21st century is, you know, kind of a, you know, one aspect of it is this intense exploration of neurology, so is it an intense exploration of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so from a perfectly secular point of view, I believe that a lot of these things make sense and will continue to make sense, and in fact may make even more sense the further we go into both technologically exploring and simulating dimensions of consciousness on the one hand, and on the other hand simply understanding more and more about how the brain and the mind interrelate, how mm-hmm. drugs enter into that relationship, how media enters into that relationship, so that we're coming to a place where our ability to understand, to probe, to trigger, to shape, to control consciousness is increasing more and more. And from that perspective, even if you're completely secular, have no belief in a world after, of higher spirits, of the Gaia mind or anything like that, but from that perspective, these explorations and experiments with consciousness that go under the guise of spirituality actually make a lot of sense. Mm. They actually have a lot to teach us, even if we don't believe the dogmas or the concepts that drive them. The experiments themselves and the way that that people organize themselves in a world in which consciousness is very important, as it is to all spiritual traditions, that these things are really directly tied in with what we're experiencing. So I don't believe that there's going to be a, it's hard to say. I mean, you could definitely see certain kinds of reactionary religion becoming even more intense over the next 10 and 20 years. But in a way, that's a separate thing than what we're talking about, because the mm-hmm. tradition I'm talking about isn't reactionary. It's not about going back and denying technology. It's about going forward into consciousness. And I think that those things will become less obviously spiritual or drawing from the mythic imagination, and more technical, more focused on the specific capacities of consciousness and how how it relates to the brain and to technology, to media, and to the sense of self. So in that sense, I think as we find out more about consciousness, as we explore consciousness more, these experiments, these experiences, these myths, these stories, histories, and fantasies are still incredibly relevant and will continue to inform that experience.
It seems like a logical conclusion for something that it perhaps defies logic in a lot of ways in terms of what we describe as spiritualism. The author is Eric Davis. The book of The Visionary State: A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape. In literally in 1 minute, I always ask, I think, one question that's unfair or certainly a stretch. I do want to quickly bring up the Led Zeppelin book, and so this is probably the most abrupt change in topics I've ever done on the show. But I do want to ask this question, and I ask it somewhat facetiously, but perhaps there's a connection. Can you draw together in your book on Zeppelin IV. You talk about the spiritualism, particularly of Jimmy Page, if you want to call it spiritualism. Obviously, it was a spiritualism focused on Satan and the darker side of what we call spiritualism. But is there a parallel at all in the growth of the Valley in terms of its spiritual dimensions and apparent conflicts to the way that Led Zeppelin IV was created? And that's probably an exceptionally difficult question, if it even makes sense.
Especially with a minute.
I'll give you 90 seconds.
I would say that the large resonance is that the technological creation of media artifacts and of mediation itself, which includes both, you know, the recording and mixing of albums that go out and sell millions of copies, and the development of more interactive networking situations and other forms of, you know, digital communication. And in both situations, we're talking about technological mediation, and that both what the Zeppelin book and what some of the stories in the Visionary State and, of course, in Technosis all point to is that process of mediation is often involved with these other much older processes of mystery, of creation of mystery and of the mysterious nature of consciousness itself, and that however secular, however rational we think we are about our technology, and particularly our media technology, that again, all you need to do is pull back the floorboards a little bit, and you're going to find a mystery. And it has different dimensions, different qualities, but that element of mysticism, that element of the unleashed imagination, that element of forms of consciousness which are tough to put into a rational box, are there. They're part of the story. They're not necessarily the most important part of the story or the driving part of the story, but they are there and have to be acknowledged if we're really going to understand the hypermediated world that we live in.
Very well done. To connect the two, but that also makes sense. Eric, for those people that want to learn more about this area broadly, any recommendations?
Well, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but the first thing you can do is stop at my website, mm-hmm. which is www.technosis.com, T-E-C-H-G-N-O-S-I-S. And I have tons of my writing is online. I've since the mid-90s, I've been posting almost everything I've written online, and so I have quite a treasure trove of different versions of these topics. I mean, there's so many different directions to go to in terms of books and other sources online. I think I'll just leave it there.
Sounds good. Eric Davis, author of The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape. Thank you so much for joining me again on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you. It was a blast.
So you've been listening to Hearsay Culture, and we're running short on time. I'm going to quickly say, for as always, I welcome you to email me suggestions for guests, comments, and what have you at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can also find the podcast any number of ways, either through hearsayculture.com, where you can also find the upcoming guests' schedule, which ranges from professors Ned Snow, Brett Frischman, Tim Holbrook, Bobby Quall, and Jonathan Zittrain, discussing various writings in the IP and technology fields, to John Walensky, who's also at Stanford, who's written an excellent book called The Access Principle on open information and sharing information, as well as Michelle Bowens, who founded the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, and Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut. The schedule continues to be amended and altered and with adding guests, and so I do encourage you to reach out to me for any suggestions you have on that front. You can find the show by going to iTunes, Center for Internet Society page, and find a podcast there, by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and you can always listen live on KZSU. Thank you so much for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I look forward to talking to you next week.